fog-addled haze of cold medicine, the Datanauts wipe the fog off the glass and peer out the window to the winter outside. Yes, as we come to the end of the year, we take a weary moment to rest and ponder and think about the year ahead. Goals. Yes, we set them. We must get smarter, stronger. Now, how are we going to do that? Labs. Yes. Yes, the lab must be even better than it is now. And here we find ourselves talking through how to improve our labs to make us stronger, smarter, faster, and better. I am Ethan Banks, and joining me is Chris Wall and Drew Conroy Murray, and this is the Datanauts podcast. Now, Chris, you were the inspiration for the show about our home lab, so why don't you give us a quick rundown on what you are running?
Well, that depends on who you ask. And if you ask my power company, a grow lab for just half an acre of pot, but they are always hitting me up and trying to nasty gram me and tell me how much more power I'm using than everyone else. But seriously, it's essentially a converted baker's rack coated with little storage arrays and white box servers from Supermicro and various switches and things like that. And that is my baby. That is my temple of IT that I use to improve myself. And so having this nice big physical lab is kind of like where I go to regenerate, renew, like, you know, when the Terminator, he's naked, he's kind of bowed down, he gets teleported back to the past. He's like, yes, I need a shirt and a jacket and a motorcycle. That's like my home lab, if that makes any sense.
I could argue the point, though. I mean, this is really a good segue into our first main thing we want to cover here is why do you even want a physical lab? This is a virtual world. Why don't we just do it all virtually? It's a lab after all, right?
And if you want a physical lab, why would you have it in your house? When you talk about things like power, you've got to keep it cool. It must make noise.
Those are pretty good questions. I'll answer the first one first. You know, why would I want a physical lab? For me, the answer was cost. There's obviously an investment on the front end to get the lab in there, but it's like buying a car versus renting a car. There's going to be hardware anywhere. Doesn't matter if I'm using a cloud lab or physical lab or whatnot. But I want to go ahead and make that investment into my lab because I want it to be always on. I want it to be there for any kind of testing that I need. And I want to just pay that off now and get to use it as much as I possibly want. So for me, it's about having access to the hardware, the gear, both the physical and the software that I want to use at any point in time. And quite frankly, I've always felt like having the ability to put my hands on hardware has value. Being able to rack and stack and plan through the configuration of all the gear, cable it together, deal with layer one problems is non-trivial. There's value there. And so those were kind of the short list for me. Now, Drew, you talked about heat and power and things like that. That's certainly true. And I've seen people have to figure out where I put the lab, you know, in my bedroom or my living room or whatever. For me, I'm lucky enough that I have a home office. And I just looked at that as a design constraint, you know, for the physical lab that it had to be pretty quiet, pretty low heat, not consume a lot of power. And so when I designed the components, I made sure that it could basically run off of 500 watts or so of power, not make a lot of noise. Basically, everything either has no fan or a fan that's so quiet you can't hear it. And then it doesn't generate so much heat that I don't need my heater in the winter kind of thing. It does put out a little bit, but I've actually done the calculations. I believe that the lab puts out as much heat as having 1.5 people in my home office, like the BTUs of 1.5 people. Huh. So that's not too bad.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, it's really funny that the first thing you said was cost, because I would think going to the cloud, going virtual would be less expensive.
I think it can be, absolutely. I'm definitely not saying that there's no comparison. For me, I wanted to have a long-running, long-standing environment that I could really just do whatever I want with. I'm not looking to have kind of a spot test. I didn't need something for a very short period of time. Having the physical kit was financially responsible because I want it to be running all the time and build out a full production kind of environment. You know, I have a 4-node cluster for running lab software. I've got a 2-node cluster running my management software. And if you're going to the cloud, I feel like if you're just doing something for a couple hours or a couple minutes or even a day or two, and then you're going to throw it away or turn it off, definitely that's going to be superbly cheap. But if you want to test with what is it like to bootstrap the hypervisor onto 4 nodes with Hanlon or Razer or something like that, if you want to test what does it look like to actually provision VLANs and configure switching and get everything to talk to one another from bare metal to putting the supervisor software, the OS software on there all the way through building on a production environment, I didn't feel like there was any cheaper way to do it than to buy a handful of white box servers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I know what you, yeah. My lab is very small compared to yours. My focus is more network centric. And so the things I've been wanting to test have been more network related. So I have two hosts, two physical hosts. You could call them white box servers, I guess. I built them myself. I actually went to Newegg and spec'd out the specific motherboard I wanted and storage and a case that would work for my rack and all of that. I have a full-size, fully enclosed network rack with heat exhaust fans on the top and louvered sides. And it's really old school, actually. It's kind of cool. I got it out of an old data center that was shutting down and they were getting rid of stuff. And, hey, boss, can I have a rack? Yeah. One thing we don't have to get rid of. Please take it home. So I got lucky, and there's still – I still damaged sheetrock in my house trying to get this monster in there because they don't make 7 foot tall fully enclosed racks with the intent of them turning sharp corners in your house. But anyway, I put that sucker in there, and yeah, so I got these two physical hosts. But my whole thing was I want to be able to run a whole bunch of different virtual machines for purposes of getting familiar with the software, plumbing them together and see how it goes. And so I have a physical rack, and I used to leave them on all the time because there was a time that I was modeling Juniper software, for example. You know, so I'd run Juniper's Junos network command line, and I would use it to model network changes, and I would test, this is the code block that's going to allow me to stand up this particular BGP configuration and that kind of stuff, for which having a physical Juniper router would be, generally speaking, cost prohibitive, and I accomplish 90% of what I want to accomplish in the virtual form factor. So the two physical hosts for me were just a platform to run a virtual machine that I could do testing with. Sounds like it's a little different from what you're doing, Chris, where you've got two node cluster that's dedicated to management and you have this set that's doing that. I mean, how many physical hosts do you actually have?
I think 7 or so. And that was kind of the transition of the lab design. You know, originally I was very focused on learning VMware. Right. And I wanted to model kind of a production-like environment. Obviously, I can't put redundancy everywhere like I would like to, but the idea was, let's look at what the design should be. Let's look at the requirements. In my case, the functional design was all about, let's emulate as much as possible a production VMware environment. And that meant having a two-node management cluster and a number of nodes for running workloads, right? And actually seeing how the vCenter relationships would work between, actually have two different vCenters that are sharing a single sign-on domain and just constructing that to be very production-like. The next iteration of the lab environment then turned into, I'm kind of okay and comfortable with the VMware world. Now it's just a private cloud to run all of the software that I need, and having those really cheap servers, you know, I think each server was like $1,000 or something like that. And if you collect them over a number of years, it's pretty low cost. Now I have the ability to run hundreds of virtual machines essentially for just the initial investment. I think I'm paying about $500 a year in power if I leave everything on 24/7. So it doesn't end up being all that expensive.
Right. It does cost, it's not nothing, but it's not super expensive either to leave those on. I mean, I went through a period this summer of getting kind of fanatical about my energy consumption because my bill was getting up to be $300 a month. And I was trying to see just how far I could drop it. So I went to LED bulbs and I started shutting down the lab unless I was actually using it. And I managed to get that bill down to a third, about roughly a third. I pay $100 to $120 a month now. How much of that was lab? I'm not entirely sure. You said $500 a year you're paying?
Yeah, about that. I have one of those little plug-in mabobs that basically UPS tells me exactly how much wattage it is, and it translates it into...
You're metering that rack, yeah, so you know exactly how much your draw is.
That's like $45 a month. Yeah, it's not too...
Yeah, bad. I mean, right. If you can afford to make the hardware investment up front, you can probably afford to pay for the electricity if you're reasonable about the servers that you buy. And I did the same thing that you did. I went conservative on the motherboard. I went SSDs. I went with quiet fans, all those things to make it more friendly in the house. And tried to make low power consumption as well with the processors I chose and so on to minimize that electrical usage. I could leave them on 24/7 if I wanted. I just kind of got in the habit of shutting them off because I've got the remote lights outboard, so I can power them up anytime I want remotely if I need.
Yeah, that's critical. Definitely key tip there for those that are going physical lab. Don't cheap out on remote KVM and remote power. That's, I would say, a requirement. If you don't have the ability to remotely manage the hardware, it really sucks having to put a crash cart or connect some kind of KVM equipment to servers, especially when you're remote. You know, all of a sudden you get an alert that a server is having an issue and you can't do anything about it till you get home and you're trying to walk a family member through. All right, press the blue button. No, not that blue button. Oh, pff, the whole lab just went down. So like Supermicro, as an example, has remote KVM just kind of standard with various motherboards, totally worth the extra $50 or whatever it is that it takes to get to those form factors.
Well, can I bring this up as a point? I'm curious to hear both of your experiences about this. You mentioned design constraints, Chris, and trying to build with those in mind. But one thing you didn't mention was family. And, you know, if you've got a spouse or a significant other or kids, that's got to affect what you bring in, where you can put it, how you keep an eye on it. How does that work?
I don't have a kids issue. I did have a spouse to deal with. That was originally a discussion that I got very little pushback on. In fact, it went pretty quickly. Just because I took the time to say, I spec'd out a server. My original lab was one Dell T110 server, which was, I think, about $1,200. Uh-huh. It was a lab in a box, you know, had storage and everything in it. And I said, I would really like to buy this server to study the VMware VCP. This was many years ago, the VMware Certified Professional exam. Had the conversation as to why I wanted to invest the money, you know, what I felt like the return would be, you know, almost building a business plan.
Right. You built the business case. Yeah.
Exactly. Just made it understandable why I wanted the equipment, that it would be in there, because I was kind of lucky. My wife knows that I'm into IT and I have been for many years, and it's not very mysterious, but I know a lot of people I've talked to, it's like, okay, you're going to put computers in the house. Why? And it's $1,000 for this computer. What is this thing? You know?
Or you're going to bring a 7-foot rack into the house and gouge out the drywall. And
so in my case, the 7-foot rack is back in a furnace room. So the way my house is laid out, we've got a split-level house, and downstairs in one corner of our house is the furnace room, and the water softener is in there, and there's kind of a work table, and it's not an area of the house that's trafficked very much, and there's a door that shuts it off from the rest of the house. So there's noise that comes out of that room already anyway. It is the furnace room, and we're in northeast US, where in the wintertime that thing kicks on pretty often, so we're kind of used to the noise that comes out of that room anyway. Adding some steady white noise that comes from the rack in the form of servers or network switches that are on is pretty muted anyway, because it's behind closed doors and wall, and you really don't notice it that much. But I will say it was a consideration. We are a quiet family, like a quiet house, and so something that was always on could have been disturbing, but we put it where we put it. It's behind that closed door, and it's okay. Now, when I built that server, though, I really did make an effort. I spent extra money on the cooling fans inside, and I made sure that the motherboard had environmental control so that those fans weren't spinning unless they needed to be spinning to cool the box down, and so on, so that there's a minimum amount of noise coming out of that thing, and put in extra fans. So there's actually two fans plus the power supply fan in there to cool that box down quickly so that the fans just wouldn't be running constantly, never quite able to keep up with the heat generated in the box. I overspec'd it just so that it would be quiet as much as possible.
And did you have that business case discussion, though?
He's his own man. He doesn't ask anyone for permission.
You know, I don't have as much of an investment as you do, Chris, I don't think. My boxes that I spec'd at the time ran something on the lines of, you know, 1,200 or so. That's not nothing, but I could justify it for the same reasons that you did, Chris. Like, this is part of my work. I need to know how to do these things and so on. And it was okay. It wasn't like I was going to have to go out and borrow money in my case to buy them. It was just, yeah, we talked about it and justified it, and it was okay. She's seen me go through this before with various certifications and so on, and kind of knows the drill of what it takes to get the job done in IT, because IT is a grinder and you got to keep your nose to it to continue to keep up and advance if you're pushing hard.
Did you guys have to like fill up the rack right away, or is this something you can do over time?
I mean, maybe
your impulse is like, I want it all right now. Let's pick them up.
Yeah, that would be great if money was not a constraint, but it always is. And that was one of the mistakes I made early on. Was my very first design. I didn't really know what I was doing with VMware. It was new to me as far as building out a cluster in the home. So I had that one server that was kind of everything. The problem with that is once you want to go beyond one server, now is that first server going to continue being storage, or I need a network switch? So I would say design for scale out. Understand that unless you're just independently wealthy, which kudos to you, I'm jealous, you're not going to be able to buy everything you want in one go. I don't think, unless you're, maybe it's a fire sale and somebody's getting rid of a bunch of equipment, but let's just assume you can't. Design as if you had everything you wanted, the full 8 or 10 server config, whatever it may be, switches, etc. And then figure out what the bare minimum is to start, and then what you think you can grow. And so for me, it's every year or so I try to add and refresh the hardware. I don't really do it any more advanced than 12-month cycle. And that way there's no throwaway equipment, not having to throw away something because you planned poorly. You know, that's expensive and wasteful, having to scrap hardware investments that you can't continue to use over 3, 4, or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So just trying to make sure to sweat those assets as much as possible because you're paying for it. It's not like your company is doing it and you just don't care. You know, that's you.
Chris, a question for you here on this. I have found that I am RAM sensitive. The more RAM I've got in the box, the happier I am because what I've tended to do with my lab machines, throw a hypervisor on them. I'm running ESXi 5.5. I didn't bother with 6 because it hasn't added much to the mix that I really needed. And I'm just wishing I had more memory in them. The boards I have maxed out at 32 gig. They were, well, I don't remember what the processor family was. And that was as big as those boards would go. I wish I had 64 and 128 would have been killer. In your world, is it the same kind of thing where memory is a constraint before CPU or?
Yeah, CPU doesn't really come up. For me, it's memory and storage performance, right? So the last build that I publicly posted on Wall Network was my Haswell build, which allowed pretty easily to do 4 DIMM sockets at 32 gigs per server. I feel like that's kind of become the bare minimum. Having 16 gigabytes of RAM in a server feels really, really low. I think 32 is really just the bar today. The problem is that the consumer tech just had not caught up yet with the memory technologies in that there was certainly ways you could do 64 or 128 gigabytes of RAM, but oh my gosh, it was almost tripling the cost of the server to do so. It did not make any sense. You would just buy more servers and spread the load, which is kind of advantageous for VMware anyways, than to just bulk up and scale up one of your servers with RAM. And that's just something that we're playing this kind of seesaw, you know, between RAM technologies and board technologies. All the boards today can support 128 plus gigabytes of RAM, but just be aware if the cost is just totally frustrating, just buy another server or wait. You know, that's the cool thing about adding to your lab. I'll do the 12-month refresh cycle and I'll look at the hardware that's out there and I'll say, there's just nothing really interesting right now. I'm going to wait another quarter, wait another 3 or 4 months and see what comes out. Or wait for the bleeding edge prices to become leading edge prices. Because there's no sense in just paying out the nose for something that adds a 5% increase in your performance.
What did you end up doing about storage? I mean, I think we both have storage stories. I definitely have some tiered storage that has some logic behind it, but let's start with yours.
I had a little bit of luck with storage in that I first started out with a little storage box that had, I think, 4 or 5 drive bays in it. And I went all hard drives, you know, all spinning Rust. And wow, that sucked. That was horrible. That was a big, big mistake.
IOPS, you mean?
Well, just performance in general. I could run maybe 5 or 6 virtual machines on this thing and it would start to kind of lean over because there's so much random I.O. going to a consumer NAS, essentially, that if you've got RAID 5 set, which is a 4+1, 4 data disk plus a parity on spinning disk, you're getting just such abysmal performance out of it that it just doesn't work. And so what I realized was that I didn't really need a lot of capacity for running these software stacks. It's pretty minimal. And the price of SATA-based flash drives are next to nothing these days. They're pretty cheap. So the next iteration, I actually went super overkill. I kind of pulled an Ethan. I bought a 12-bay Synology NAS, and I put 12 flash drives in it. And I rated that together. And, you know, I can get 30+ thousand I.O. out of it with about a terabyte of usable space. And so far, that thing has just been a workhorse.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go quite that big. I bought a Synology. It's an 8-bay drive. I did not put flash in it. This particular chassis, which if I remember right, it's an 1813 plus. It's an 8-bay chassis that does have the option to put in flash as a caching tier. So you do 2 flash and the rest spinning Rust if you want. Only all the research I did on it, it doesn't help hardly any particular storage load. Wasn't advantageous. So I just stuffed them full of 4 terabyte drives, did a Synology RAID 6. You lose 2 drives out of it. I ended up with about 21 terabytes of usable storage. And the idea was for the Synology was big, slow storage. I don't actually use it for much other than a system needs to write logs that I'm testing, or I need to dump some big files or use it for the image server, these kind of things. That's what the Synology is for. In my hosts, I've got flash, 256 gig flash drives, and that's where my virtual machines boot from. And they are fast. I mean, it's awesome. So I do thin provisioning, run the virtual machine image right off of flash. It boots up very, very quickly. And then if I need more storage for that VM, I aim it towards the Synology, again, the big, slow storage. And that's worked fine for me because of the kinds of VMs that I tend to run, which, again, are very network-centric. I don't need a lot of storage to run, say, a Cisco CSR 1000V. I don't have to have a lot of onboard storage with it. I got to boot the thing, but it's not the kind of a device that is accumulating lots and lots of data. The same thing with any sort of a virtual router, virtual firewall, et cetera. You can get away with thin provisioning for a very long time and stretch that 256 gig flash drive much further than you'd think. You can do really well with it.
Yeah. And I remember you talking about in your lab post, you wanted to run F5 and Brocade and the Cisco gear and the Juniper gear and all that kind of stuff. And that makes sense. It doesn't need a lot of space. And it sounds like you don't really care if the host failure impacts it. You know, you can just start it up somewhere else.
No, exactly right. And that's what I did. Since I had the two hosts, I tend to boot in twins. If I did a switch on host A, I'd also do another one just like it on host B and, you know, run them in parallel, which is very often how you do network design anyway. You're running a lot of things as twins. And so that worked very effectively for me, with the exception of things like the big IP F5 box that is married to a license, and it's a little pricier if you want to have two of them and so on, or to move it.
And in my case, I think I run about 30 or 40 virtual machines powered on at any given time. A lot of them are Windows. I'm doing a lot with Active Directory, got a various vCenter servers. I'm running a lot of different pieces of software. And in order to get that kind of production-like VMware environment, I needed to support things like vMotion and high availability. That means shared storage has to be presented. Shared storage needs to be performant. And that's why I ultimately just kind of bit the bullet and said, I'm just going super overkill with flash. I think the takeaway that I'd like to offer to our listeners is, I've actually written a post on it, the various ways you can slice and dice home storage. There's the way that Ethan talked about where you could potentially have a caching tier in your storage, you know, like with the Synology having two flash drives and maybe six spinning drives. I'm not a huge fan of that just because it tends to be helpful for reads, but for writes, it just doesn't do anything.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not very helpful in a lot of cases.
Or it can be, depending on the array, can be a bottleneck at the network anyway, if it's like only fed by 1 gig. And it just might not help you because you'd actually need 10 gig going into the thing to get much of a benefit. You just moved your bottleneck somewhere else.
Right. And the mapping for the cache, I believe, for the Synology is in the RAM. And I think the biggest you can get on some of those units is like 2 gigs of RAM, 3 gigs of RAM. So very little amounts of the cache is actually addressable by the read and write cache. Then the other alternative was actually putting flash drives in the server and using something like Pernix Data or Infinio to cache on the server. Then the challenge is, where do you get the software licensing for that? Also, there's the VMware vFlash read cache, which I think died and then kind of came back from the grave. It can work. I went the other route. I actually run 4 Synology arrays. 2 of them are all flash. 2 of them are all capacity disk. And that way, I just have 2 of them dedicated to performance and 2 of them dedicated to capacity. And the reason that I have 4 is basically 2 are production and 2 are for lab, just because I wanted to really emulate as much as I can a legitimate environment. That's why everything's kind of divided into production, which runs my Active Directory server for the home. It runs all of my management components. And then lab stuff, where I don't really care if it survives necessarily. It's meant to be, you know, ephemeral in a sense.
Now, one other thing I wanted to mention about the physical lab host that I built. Each motherboard has 4 1 gigabit NICs on them. Now, why 4? Do I need the bandwidth? I don't need the bandwidth, but I wanted the design flexibility. I wanted to be able to dedicate a specific physical NIC to some function. And then buying that built onto the motherboard was way cheaper than, say, you know, buying a Intel 1000x4 NIC of some kind and then using up a slot on the motherboard to deal with that. I like having that many NICs. So I actually have a 5 cables running into the back of each of these lab servers, you know, 4 for different network segments, and then the 5th one for the remote lights out control. Are you much of a believer in that, Chris, or are you actually running 10 gig as opposed to 1? Or?
Oh, I wish. The only issue for me with 10 gig is the noise. The form factors for 10 gig is just, it's kind of pricey, but I'm willing to eat that cost, but it's so loud, I just can't run it because my lab is in my home office.
Because of the heat that gets generated in the switch. You're talking about the network switch that would be plumbing the 10 gig into.
Yeah. That's a good clarification. The network switch itself, with the fans and everything running in there, it's just too noisy. There are some new developments going on in that space where you can get quieter or even potentially fanless, but I'm holding on, waiting for that. What I run for my hosts, first off, I want no single points of failure, so I run a couple different cards in all of my servers. I've got the onboard, which is, I believe, 2 network interfaces. One of them I use for the remote IPMI, the KVM. But other than that, I have at least a pair of dual port 1 gig NICs in each server, mostly just so that I can spread my network interface cards across the switches that I connect to, so that if I lose one of my two switches or if I lose one of my two cards, it's not going to impact the host. It's not going to go down. And in some cases, I've actually found people that were getting rid of 4-port 1-gig cards, which was awesome. And I stuck those in the servers too. So I have a lot of ports that aren't being consumed, and I'm just trying to continue to go along with that best practice enterprise architecture model where there's no single points of failure across cards or links.
Yeah, that's important for testing some things. I've actually consolidated a bit just to simplify. So I actually run my lab off of one 48-port 1-gig switch, a Cisco SG300. It's their small business line. It's quite a capable little switch, surprisingly, non-blocking. Doesn't route a lot if you need like a lots and lots of routing table entries. It only does like 400. Other than that, it's a non-blocking layer 3 full forwarding switch. So it doesn't get in the way of anything you're trying to do. Cheap and cheerful, as they say. But rather than have two switches and full redundancy and all that, I just simplified and did it for one because for my purposes, that was good enough, which I guess kind of goes to a bigger point, Chris. There's no one right lab. You can go as bonkers as you want, as limited only by your money and your imagination and tolerance for an electric bill. But you don't have to. Figure out what it is you're trying to do and then build to that spec.
Ethan, I really like the Data Knots podcast. What should I do?
You should do two things. One, Chris, tell your friends. And when you've told them, you're going to make them subscribe. And I don't care what it takes. Bribe them with donuts. You can expense it to the Data Knots if that's what you need to do. Whatever it takes. Two, you yourself must subscribe. And you can do that. Do you know how to do that?
Push button, get banana.
You go up to packetpushers.net/subscribe, and every show on Packet Pushers is on that page, including Data Knots, this very show. And if you don't want to do that because that's too hard, do you know what else you could do?
I don't know. I've ran out of ideas with the banana thing.
Okay. You can search in iTunes. If you're an Apple user, you like iTunes, search in there, find the Data Knots podcast, or you can use a great podcast app like Overcast. Just search for Data Knots. You'll find it, and you can click subscribe.
Thanks, Ethan.
You're welcome, buddy.
Hi, this is Drew saying thanks to today's sponsor, InROP. InROP is the leading independent IT conference, and the Packet Pushers are putting together a two-day Future of Networking Summit for InROP Las Vegas 2016. The goal of the summit is to identify current and emerging technologies that are going to affect the networking industry over the next 5 to 10 years. And we're bringing in special guests, experts, practitioners, and of course, the Packet Pushers themselves. We'll talk about the changing state of network operations, advances in network hardware and silicon, open networking, SD-WAN, containers, and more. You can join us for live podcast recordings, and we'll have an after-hours hangout, too. And besides the Future of Networking Summit, InROP's assembling a full slate of independent, top-notch content on security, virtualization, IT leadership, SDN, and more. So make your plans now to join us at InROP Las Vegas, May 2nd through the 6th, at the beautiful Mandalay Bay Hotel. Use the code PPUSHERS when you register, and you can get 25% off 5-day, 3-day, and 2-day conference passes. We hope to see you there, and now back to the conversation.
Chris, we've been talking a whole lot about our physical home labs and, you know, aren't we cool? We did all that stuff. But I know that there are people out there rightly thinking, come on, guys, cloud and vendor labs have everything I need. Why the heck do I want to build something in my house? I don't want that burden. I just want it to be in the cloud. I will power it on virtually when I need it and do my thing. Have you dug into those options much? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest one for me personally, actually, the Cisco Cloud Lab. I think it's only for partners, back to when I work at a VAR/consulting company, but it's this kind of globally located set of Cisco gear all over the world that you can rent, per se. You know, you can kind of say, I want to borrow the equipment for so many hours or whatever, and you can get access to a Cisco Nexus 5K or 7K or fiber channel gear, whatever you want, for a little while. So it's physical gear that's in a quote-unquote cloud. And for me, that was huge. I couldn't get my hands on stuff that could do switching and things like that virtually. I know the virtual internet routing lab, the viral stuff, exists today, but back then it didn't exist. And to actually put your hands to bootstrap UCS and Nexus gear and actually get to see it all connected in a fairly complex topology with 4, 5, 6 pieces of network gear, it's just cost prohibitive. Where are you going to get a 7K? That thing's like $100,000+.
Yeah. That's a significant discussion with a significant other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Honey, I want to put a 7K in here. How big is that? Oh, 23U. No big deal. So.
And your power company. You couldn't power it if you wanted to off of a wall socket.
Yeah, that's why are you putting in redundant 60-amp circuits? Don't worry about that. Yeah. So for me, the vendor stuff, it's just not even a discussion from a physical perspective. You're either working for a VAR that has the gear on premises, or you're using these partner labs. There is no buy it and put it in my house. For me, that was Cisco's Cloud Lab. EMC has a bunch of e-learning for their physical storage gear, and so on and so forth. Those vendor labs are just critical, especially if you're looking to take their certifications. When I did the CCNA data center, the Cloud Lab was my buddy. I had like a favorite link on my desktop where I'd go into it almost every day.
Yeah, and if you're studying for something like Cisco CCIE, there are a number of vendors out there that will rent you rack time. A lot of times the companies that are doing instruction also have a business of renting racks. And so why invest in a whole bunch of switches and routers so you can do CCIE lab work at home if you can rent a rack and get the job done probably with gear that's a little bit more current and a little bit, especially if you're doing something crazy like CCIE data center, like you were saying, Chris, that involves storage gear and Nexus gear, the stuff that's, you know, huge dollars. Yeah, you're going to want to rent a rack in that case. I'll mention Cisco Viral as well, since you brought it up. I have taken to doing a lot of my labbing for at least Cisco-oriented network stuff on Viral running on my iMac. I run an iMac as my primary workstation. I stuffed it full of memory. It's got 32 gig of memory. I'm running VMware Fusion, and I run a Viral instance in there. I devote 16 gig of RAM of the 32 physical that's in this iMac. 16 gig of RAM goes to Viral, and I can do a lot in that. I can build some pretty sizable network models and do a number of things to prove out different routing concepts, and there's switching you can do, and there's a number of Cisco images that you can run inside of that that doesn't require me to fire up one of the lab machines that's in the rack downstairs that we were talking about earlier in the show. And so there is something to be said for that. GNS3, the graphical network simulator, those network people are very familiar with GNS3 that's out there. And there's other ones that we've had on some of the Packet Pushers podcast channels that also allow you to do that and have it all be local. I mean, there's something to be said for that, running VirtualBox if you don't like VMware Fusion, which you pay for. And you can get a lot done right in your local machine. Just stuff it full of RAM. And if you have a laptop and you're on the go, you've got your lab with you. You don't have to worry about VPNing back to the house, to the home lab, if you will. That's useful. Vendor labs, again, Chris, I just wanted to highlight that there are, in the networking space, vendors that are starting to get big on this. You know, Big Switch Networks, for example, if you're a prospect and you want to test things out, they will allow you to test drive their stuff in the lab. They built a lot of custom lab environments that it isn't just, well, log in here and you get a command line and good luck, kid. It's actually very structured, and it walks you through how their product works and how to build a full-on environment that would be useful to you in production, only it's all virtual. It's all happening up in the cloud. That seems to be happening more and more with vendors. You just got to ask the question, and it's very possible that they're going to have an option for you to try things out that way.
What's the price tag on a vendor lab?
Depends. Maybe nothing. If you're a customer, it may not cost you anything. You know, as a quote-unquote influencer in my role with Packet Pushers and as a writer and so on, I've had access to some of these labs for free because they wanted to demonstrate the product and have me be able to speak literally about what's going on. So I wouldn't say there's always there may not be a price tag at all if you're a genuine prospect, someone that they're going to be selling to, because it's considered part of their sales process.
But if you're going for a certification or something, I presume they're not going to let you necessarily do it for free.
Well, let's take Viral. Viral is not free. Viral, you pay a variety of prices depending on if you're a student or an enterprise and how many licenses you need. But you're into at least 100, maybe 200 bucks a year to run Viral as a subscription, for example. Mm-hmm. Revelo Systems, they have been a sponsor on Packet Pushers in the past, and I think many of us have worked with their product. They give you the opportunity to build a library of lab environments and stand them up in the Amazon or Google Cloud on the fly without you having to know anything about Google or Amazon. That is not free. Again, you pay to store images in the Revelo Cloud, and then you pay for the time that you're actually running the lab environment on Amazon or Google. They pass that cost through to you. Awesome product, just outstanding, really good stuff. And they continue to work on it and tweak it so you can do all sorts of things with it. But again, not free.
I think it breaks down to, if you need vendor access for physical equipment, that's where you kind of demarket in my mind. You know, so when I was talking about the Cisco Gold Lab and Cloud Lab and the EMC labs, you're getting access to actual physical gear because some of the stuff you need to learn just requires that. Like I said, getting access to some of these Nexus switches, the cost is not going to make sense. And so there's really no cost to that. It's really just, are you in the channel or working for a partner at a certain status level where you can get access to it? Even if you're not in that environment, that's okay, because you probably know a partner or a channel partner that you're working with anyways. And a lot of them are going to be nice enough to let you shoulder surf or come in and work out of a hotel desk in their office and use them anyways. And they just won't tell anybody. So lean on these people, because if you've got a decent relationship with your channel partners, they're going to do whatever they can to help you out, bend over backwards to make you happy. And there's no cost to them to use this gear anyways.
Sometimes you don't even have to lean that hard. You know, for example, Cisco has a number of regional offices, and frequently there'll be some lab area in those regional offices. And so if you're a customer with a reasonable Cisco relationship, you can talk to your rep and say, hey, I need a day or 2 days that I can model X, because we're in the middle of this project and we're going to be buying equipment and, you know, and so on. It's easier for them to justify if it's tied to a sale. But yeah, you go down to the regional office, you spend a day or two there in the lab environment. They will have worked with you and help you got things set up, answer questions, and you can put your hands on that gear. And all of that's incumbent on you is getting to the regional site, you know, whatever that is.
Exactly. And then there's other programs where I think you're just basically buying access to software. In my case, I would lump that with F5's Big IP Virtual Edition that Ethan brought up, as well as VMware has the Eval Experience program that I think is tied kind of closely with the VMware user group, where you pay a annual fee and they give you access to dozens of various VMware software licenses that you can install wherever, in addition to their hands-on labs from VMware, which are absolutely free. Usually when it's just, I want access to software, it's a hosted lab, and it's not physical hardware bound, there's little to no cost. It's where you need physical kit that it starts to get a little bit more tricky.
So what if I'm independent and I want to go play around with public cloud stuff instead of being tied to a specific hardware vendor or VMware?
Just pull out your credit card.
Jump
that's,
in.
That's pretty much it, yeah. And actually, that's a good point, because some of the software guys, like the automation software guys, Puppet stands out in my mind, has this great learning virtual machine that you can either download or potentially put into a public space. And with the Puppet one in particular, you launch the learning virtual machine and it's like a video game. You log into it and it's like, this is your first quest. I need you to connect a node to the Puppet Master. It follows along with you, and as you type the commands like quest completed, zero cost. You can put it locally on VMware Workstation or on ESXi or whatever like that. And I'm seeing a lot of that, either something you download or something more like Codecademy, where it's completely based on HTML5. You just log into a web browser and it takes you through in a very gamified way. I think the cost is just so negligible. It's like 3 cups of coffee and you own the software for a month. It's totally worth it.
Hi, everybody. We'll get back to the podcast in just a minute, but I want to thank today's sponsor, ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, visibility diminishes, which is a huge problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. That's where ThousandEyes comes in. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on, your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. Cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. With ThousandEyes, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, such as device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, and more. You can share data and insights with vendors and customers to resolve problems faster. And here's a special offer just for listeners. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see. And now back to the podcast.
So Chris, we've talked about physical labs, we've talked about cloud labs, vendor labs, just to kind of think outside the box if we don't want to be married to our own infrastructure that we bought. Is there a right answer here for the future? I mean, as we look ahead to our lab environments, are there other things we haven't talked about that are maybe worth considering as we look down the road of labbing?
You hit upon it earlier. You were talking about using VMware Fusion because you're an Apple guy. Ugh. But for those of us that choose the correct operating system, we might be using VMware Workstation, which runs on PCs that are using Windows, the world's greatest operating system. But anyways, the point I'm trying to make is that today, a laptop with a decent amount of RAM, and you can get a lot of RAM in laptops these days. Even my tablet has 8 gig, but I think 16 gig of RAM in a laptop is pretty financially achievable, even getting up to 32, which, man, a laptop with 32 gigabytes of RAM, that's as much as my servers have. It makes me feel old just saying that. But there's various pieces of software, VirtualBox, VMware Workstation, VMware Fusion are a couple examples. And I see a big trend where, especially the OpenStackers that are using things like Vagrant to test software, where basically you download the image, Vagrant up, and all of a sudden you have whatever virtual machine based on the Type 2 hypervisor that you're using on your laptop. So you can build a fully fledged, complex set of infrastructure on your laptop, meaning there's no network switching to worry about. There's no WAN connectivity to worry about. You can put together this complex two or three tier software stack on your laptop, play with it, and then throw it away. Or even go like the container route and run some port mapped or private IP mapped Docker containers on your laptop, something like that, just to play with something. And it's very immutable. You know, you just download it, play with it, and throw it away. And that eliminates all those other options. You know, it's not cloud, it's not physical lab per se, it's just your laptop. I feel like that's becoming really popular, and it should. And as we continue to see the power of consumer tech grow, it's just going to become more and more popular.
Yeah, I'll put a plug in for VMware Fusion and VirtualBox. So there's a couple of things here. One, VirtualBox is free. I don't think there's tons of development going into VirtualBox these days. It's not like it's, you know, the software's advancing by leaps and bounds, but does it let you run virtual machines on your laptop? Yeah. Are there a lot of images out there that will run in VirtualBox? You bet. That's the default, as you were pointing out, Chris, for certain open source communities. When they're making their test images, the expectation is you're probably running them on VirtualBox. VMware Fusion, I'm on a Mac, right? So think VMware Workstation. Those are the paid tiers, the fancy virtual machine environments. I guess it's a hypervisor, kind of, sort of.
Yeah, it's a Type 2 hypervisor is the technical name for it. And it's not very expensive. By saying paid, I don't want people to think thousands. I think it's $100 or somewhere in that neighborhood.
Depending on which flavor you get, because there's a pro version or not. I think the pro version of VMware Fusion was either $150 or $250. I've forgotten. And they'll tag you for upgrades along the way. So it's definitely not nothing. But yeah, it's not thousands. Yeah, for sure. And then you get integration into other VMware environments. For example, VMware Fusion can see, oh, you've got an ESXi host on this other machine and let you do operations against it and so on, migrate images between systems. And so if you're heavy into VMware, it's a nice tool to have. And there's an awful lot of images out there that will run just happily on ESXi without you having to do anything. On the other hand, I will say there are some OVAs you can download that don't run right, because you try to import it into VMware Fusion and it just chokes on an XML parameter. And you end up having to do a conversion process. And I've spent some amount of hours converting OVAs meant to run on VirtualBox to make them work on either ESXi or VMware Fusion. They both have the same problems if that OVA is not spec'd exactly right. But the freedom you get being able to run these virtual machines on your laptop is great. You've got portability. You've got the lab anywhere you go. Sitting on a plane, if you're a traveler, that can be a big deal. Assuming they haven't actually put the person in front of you literally in your lap so you can still get your laptop open. And Chris, as you say, you kind of abstracted away from having to deal with all the physical infrastructure and the plumbing and building VLANs and networks and so on. All of that stuff. There'll be instructions maybe that ask you to tweak this or fiddle with that, but most of the time it just works. You don't have to think about that stuff, and you can get down to the what is it you're trying to do with this virtual machine and actually use it rather than spend time fiddling with it and configuring it just to get to a point that there's something useful that you can do now.
Yeah, it really hit me when I was at Interop earlier this year, 2015, and I went to a workshop by Matt Oswalt where he was basically teaching Jinja 2 and Ansible and Python. And he ran it all on his laptop, all using Vagrant. And, you know, Vagrant up, type a few command arguments in there, and bam, he had a full-featured environment. He was teaching Ansible and Python on a laptop, full-fledged demo lab environment with no dependencies on WAN. And if you've been to conferences and whatnot, you know the internet loves to punish people who like to be ballsy with live demo. And so at least having that off the table can help. And the fact that he could just totally develop it, put it all on GitHub, and then pull it down onto his laptop was really cool. It kind of blew my mind. That's when I started looking into things like that.
It does underscore that memory requirement we were just talking about, though. If you want to do that, as much memory as you can put in your machine, the better. It's not like running Fusion or VirtualBox somehow negates the need for these virtual machines to have memory. If these virtual machines need a gig or 2 gig or 4 gig or 8 gig to run. Well, that's what they need. So you're going to have the physical RAM to support that, even though it's all a virtual environment. Again, that requirement for memory doesn't just disappear. And so more memory is definitely better. 16 at least and 32 is better.
And definitely a flash drive for the laptop is non-negotiable. So no spinning disk for the laptop. Especially if you're running multiple Vagrant nodes or multiple virtual machines, that spinning disk, especially with their 5400 RPM crappy little laptop drives, are just going to puke.
And I wouldn't put a lot of stock in those Fusion drives either. Those tend to
those hybrid
run out of steam awful quick. Yeah, yeah. They'll have some small amount of flash on them, but the performance falls off a cliff pretty quickly just as soon as what you need is no longer on that flash tier.
My last laptop had one of those. I immediately removed the SATA drive that was a spinning disk and put a flash drive in there and then disabled the cache. What's the price of a 256 gig, 2.5-inch drive? It was negligible compared to the performance that I get out of it. It's like a 3,000% performance increase for, you know, an extra $100. It's a no-brainer.
I guess another thing, just think about physical lab stuff, though, Chris. I think there's an expectation you have to set that, you know, this stuff isn't going to last you 5 years, you know, and you don't want to buy it as if it needs to last you 5 years. You really kind of want to think about quick replacement. I think you said, what, every 12 months?
Every 12 months, I do two things. I look at seeing what is outdated and seeing when I need to grow, right? So those are great growth points because I'm not going to buy everything in one shot. So I know that I've got all these servers now. These servers were purchased over the last 4 or 5 years, one at a time, two at a time. I don't have the money to buy 8 servers at once. And so I think it's important to understand that you're going to grow and that you're going to have more performance out of the newer stuff, but also don't try to sweat the asset to the point where it's killing your lab. I had a little 8-port crappy, it was some switch that like didn't even have a name on it practically. It was like this little green mystery box. I kept holding on to it forever. It was like my baby. And I finally let it go when I bought the same switch you did, the SG300 52 port, and then retired that thing. And so just understand that these are sunk costs. You've gotten value out of it. You've learned something from it. You don't have to keep it forever. Eventually, give it to Goodwill. Give it to a friend. Someone else will find a home for it for sure.
The takeaway that I've got here from this last session is that if I'm new to labs, then it seems like an easy way to start is just beefing up a laptop and pulling down some tools and seeing how it goes. And even if nothing comes of it, at the end of the day, I've still got a kick-ass laptop.
Yeah, and then you can play StarCraft on it. And you know. Yeah, for sure. I mean, everyone needs a decent performant laptop, right? So it's definitely a relatively cheap way to start. If you think of a server, a pretty decent white box Supermicro server, costing, Ethan, you were saying, what, $1,200, somewhere in that neighborhood?
Yeah, that was, soup to nuts, that's about what I spent.
Yeah, and you're going to need a laptop anyways, and I think bare minimum decent laptop is probably $1,000. So if you just beef up your laptop above and beyond the price of one server, then you've got that awesome laptop, and you've got something you can use for lab environments. The plane point that Ethan makes, if you're traveling, planes, trains, automobiles, whatever, it's actually really a great point because you're not doing anything over the plane Wi-Fi if you're trying to connect back to a lab. Not,
no, you're not.
Not with any consistency. You know? So, local is great for when you're on those silver flying tubes. You know, the one last thing I wanted to put out there for our listeners, because I love all of you, you're all my friends. As you're working through a lab, it's fun to geek out about the hardware. It's fun to think about, oh, I'm putting together this lab. And I mean, it is a lot of fun. It gets my nerd knobs going for sure. But the goal is to learn something, to improve your skills. And because maybe you're trying to bust your silos, that's definitely a theme that we tried to promote on DataKnots. You're a server person trying to learn networking or network to server or storage or whatever it is. As you're going through that learning process, be cognizant of how your brain learns, of how you're able to absorb knowledge. In this, I would say, from doing this for many, many years, smaller bites are better than big bites. Learn for little bits at a time. I have a couple posts on what's called the Pomodoro technique, where you essentially do 25-minute increments of learning followed by 5 or 10-minute increments of rest or distraction. And these little 25-minute pieces of focus help you absorb and retain knowledge. Don't try to cram all night like you did in high school or college for that big exam, right? Because you may be able to regurgitate it the next day for an exam, but it's not going to stick with you. Make sure to schedule yourself advantageously, research, plan, and schedule your time, and try to do little bites of learning so that you get the most value out of all this money that you spent on a physical lab or the per hour, per minute, whatever charge you're paying for your cloud lab.
Chris, you hit on something kind of interesting a little earlier. You just said, hey, you guys that listen are our friends. And yeah, that's exactly how I feel about it. All of you in the audience, you're friends. We're all fellow engineers. We're all in this together, just sharing knowledge. That's what it's all about. And so we genuinely hope you got something out of our experiences. And if you've got things to add, you can tweet at us. Let us know if you got any questions or thoughts or things you want to share about your labs, or maybe you've written about your lab and you want us to retweet it. We're happy to do that if you've got a good write-up of your home lab so that other people can see what you've accomplished. Chris has written up his home lab, walnetwork.com/my-home-lab. I've written about it, ethancbanks.com. There's no way I'm reading the entire URL, but if you search for Home Lab ESXi on ethancbanks.com, you'll find this thing I wrote back in March 2014.
We'll also make sure to get them in the show notes.
Exactly. At packetpushers.net, you can find the show notes for this show, which will include the links to our labs. And that is it for today's show. You can reach me at EC Banks, Chris at Chris Wall, Drew at Drew_CM. And for more superb DataNauts content, head on over to packetpushers.net and partake on the bountiful feast of podcast goodness. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Bro hug. All right, that was good.